Hi, this is H.P. Smith, trying to recall some things of early Wallingford days. Today is 28th March, 2001. Cold, bit windy, overcast, snow, a foot and a half outside, and not too pleasant storm coming this evening. A combination of snow and rain. Well, a mere 30, 40 years ago, after leaving Wallingford to come up here, it was easier to think about early days in 1938, 30s, of our early times in Wallingford. We didn't have any great beneficiaries to keep us happy each day with our presence of any kind. So we had to improvise all our playthings or toys. I remember in 1938, 36, 38, right in there, the fireworks were of always great importance on 4th of July. My father set up a program so that we had a glorious 4th of our own every time. He was an old aficionado of the early days where they had unlimited fireworks access. Well, he always stored them top shelves so no one could look at them except when the day came on July 4th. Had a decision to make after all these episodes. My mother asked us, myself, she asked, tell me, of 2 days of the year, of the two that I'm going to choose for you, feel to have the most important, is it going to be Christmas or is it going to be 4th of July? If only one of those you could have. Now tell me what it is. Well, I had a human hobby. Christmas came, bicycles and all kinds of great things like that, but oh gee whiz, I couldn't give up 4th of July, so I had to say, had to have 4th of July rather than Christmas. Well, that started the thinking plan early of an assemblance of 4th of July pre and after, so there wouldn't always just have to be one glorious day. Well, we lived in a town where they had the largest fireworks manufacturing company, M. Backus's Star Brand Fireworks on South Elm Street. We knew the families a little bit, but mostly we knew the manufacturing plant and all the accessories that go with it. Five stories, big brick buildings down there. And we had experimented with our own days of 1936, 1937, 1938, 1939. We could not own a firearm. My father wasn't into that. He had too many other things to do. And he just put off any idea of any kids even having a BB gun. Okay, so we had to have clay wooden facsimiles of cowboys and Indians, Flintlock, Daniel Boone, and all the old Revolutionary War repros that my brother built on pine planks carved with beautiful processing of the walnut-type stock, but it was a pine-stained walnut, and a gas pipe of half-inch diameter, and a touch hole which you could insert a one-and-a-half-inch firecracker, Chinese-type, with a holder on the trigger arm for the, what they call a matchlock, which was nothing but a punk made of old clothesline that was frayed up and lit, or a piece of firework punk that they used in those days. And you'd light that and you could light the firecracker in the cup. Now, when a barrel of the gun just makes a certain noise, it's better to have it have a projectile. So you could find certain marbles or MIGs that would fit the half-inch bore, You could push those down, and you could just thin them out. And after a while, you could find sooner or later that it worked better with a wad pushed down the tissue paper first. And then, on top of that, more than just make some marble-type things, you could get ball bearings, nuts, bolts, you name it, that would fit in there. Well, you could break a Coke bottle at a good 6 feet if you were really concentrating and there was no flinch when that firecracker went off. Remember, before OSHA, no face mask, safety glass, or whatever. Gases around us, so we had a built-in flinch to keep the eyes closed when it went off. Actually, it wasn't too good, but by gosh, we had a gun. And then we came upon a dump up there in Goshen, up on the next farm, Freeman Sears, Claire Sears' place. And in that dump, we found a wooden rifle stock for a 22 caliber flow bearer indoor rifle that shot BB caps. There was the barrel and the action were missing, but the stock was whole. It still had the filigree trigger guard and the grip and butt plate, all very ornate, and it was a great experience to have that stock. All we had to do was build a fake barrel on it, and boy, we could carry that everywhere in the streets of Wallingford, Connecticut, and everybody would come running up the street, especially the big teenagers, you know, older than we were at the time, and say, hey, can we have a couple shots out of your gun? Oh, that was phenomenal, because that gave us encouragement that they actually thought we had a real gun, but we had to say, our fathers and mothers don't want us to shoot anybody else to shoot the gun, so we'd march home rather gloriously that we had been flattered to think we had a real gun. Well, things got better to better as we came along. We found the boys' book of projects for mechanically carpentry-inclined youth of the 1900s in a shelf in Goshen Library from my father's and uncle's old treasure trove. And in that was a whole series of phenomenal number of projects for young people to make of their own. Everything from pumps to boat systems to all kinds of things, tree houses. But above those things was our own fireworks manufacturing process. It had the formula for original black powder. So much sulfur, so much saltpeter, so much charcoal. Well, we found that you could buy the sulfur and you'd get the charcoal right out of your own fireplace that we had all over in the 1780 house. And there were plenty of fireplaces, wood burning all the time, as well as a coal-fired wood-type converted furnace. So we still had it access to charcoal, but the saltpeter you could still get from the drugstore. And Rand's drugstore, and you'd order it, and a pound of it, or half a pound of it, whatever it was, sulfur. We'd take that home and mix it in our mother's pestle and mortar. The percentages escape my mind, but they're pretty rudimentary, and they're there. You had a little penny scale that would put nickels and dimes and pennies on it. You could balance out for the given weights that you had in the book would tell you what they were valued for. It was a tiny little beam balance that you hang on a little hook, and you had it, and you could get a balance of so much weight of each ingredient to make our own black powder. Well, that was a new thing. If you make your own, we were ahead of the game, we thought. We made it, and we had to make the fuse, of course. We go to the store, grocery stores, 1930s, had big sheets of paper, and string came from a ball from the ceiling that was reeled off down there with a string right over the market's counter, and you'd wrap up whatever your project was, whatever your food systems were, and you could get them by the pound that were shoveled onto the paper and completely wrapped and tied. So you always had packages of that type at the store, plenty of string. So that string was the basis for our fuse systems for the powder. Use the saltpeter, alcohol mixed in a saucer, and you would lay the string in a circle, curlicues all the way around till finally you got a good yard or more in each saucerful, and let it stay in there, and then pull it out after it's so saturated and hang it. from your upstairs window, and you could get the sun on it and then dry it out. Now, you test that when you light it, and you could see it burn, but it burned very, very erratically. It didn't have much quality control for the program, so there's always a little burn just everywhere from an inch or two, and then another 3 or 4 inches would leap forward, and then 2 inches, 3 inches. So you had to have a safety factor always thrown into your program that would allow for a non-uniform burning fuse. Well, that's okay, but we just had plenty of strings, so 3 foot of fuse would always be ahead of our system. Now, the systems were, in the beginning, regular annealed copper tubing, anywhere from 6 inch to a foot to, well, anywhere which your pennies could afford, from Daily Plumbing. 1 inch ductile copper tubing. In that tubing, you put a little wad down one end, you crimp it in the vise, turn it over, crimp it again, and then you would pour in your homemade process. And have a touch hole at the one end, but you'd also crimp at the other end after you put a wad of newspaper down in, so the crimp would not be in on the explosive at all. And rolled it into it and fold it over and bend it and fold it over in the vise a couple of times. Now you had a cylinder of everywhere from 3, 6, 10, 14, whatever inches you felt you could spare. But to test the devices, we had to take them down into the trees off the front porch in a lot that was semi-vacant, but it had a hay lot that Mr. Ives had a man named Hall come up with a mixed team, one mule and one oxen, that pulled this four-foot sickle bar mower, McCormick, all through the fields. And that mowed that, but there was a few old dead apple trees in there, stuff, and father down the end. We could hang those devices in a tree and set them up with our fuse and stand back at the porch on a summer night and sit there in the rocking chairs and wait. As you could see the burning fuse at a good 150 yards away, burning, slowly up to where we felt it was about the height of the tree, and then orange-red flash, sometimes, not always, and it would so boom, puff, and then you wait 2 or 3 seconds for the next one to come off, and then you wait another 30 seconds for the next one to go off because the fuses were not uniform, and then you had 2 or 3 of them go off, and then we'd say they're not too good this time, we got to be more careful in the process. Well, all this experimenting also got us more practical so we could get a little closer to the idea. We bought ourselves and made ourselves a cannon that was made of black iron pipe, 1 inch nominal, threaded, lug at the end, hole for fuse. We pack our stuff in there and put the wad in, and then whatever shooter, marble, or bolt or nut you could find that would fit down would help out, and aim at the back fence at MC Wooding Company's area where they stored lumber, and it was just a good 50 yards back area, which was a good testing ground, and you could shoot into that, and you could check for the bullets that bounce off, and not one or two of them would stick in, but very few soft pine picket fence, those boards in the back of that. Well, we still had an inkling that it was working all right, but not as good as we'd hoped. The cannons were then as works of art for beautiful carriages, which extended on and on to lawnmower wheels and 2x4s and cross pieces, and oh, they were beautiful systems. They looked official. They really did. And everybody came to look at them, try out, and we were sort of frustrated by our propellant explosive. It was not too good. So it was the hiatus of waiting of some other process. Now, knowing we were too young to be able to purchase any such supplies from a legitimate source, we had another one that came by the graciousness of the testing controls of the M. Backus Fireworks Company of Wallingford, Connecticut in 1936, 1937, and 1938. They had Friday night inspections every, I don't know, two or three weeks that they would take and test all the fireworks from the five-story building. They used a two-inch salutes, three-inch, five-inch, six-inch salutes, real bangers that would, in the days when my father was around, they said they made them so big so they were all the cobblestones in the street, you could go and lift them out after firing them in the good old days of 1900. Six and seven around there. Well, we were later past our real time, but still we were going to experiment some more. And we found that they dumped at Friday nights a certain amount of fireworks off a bridge at night into the water. Meanwhile, there's no environmental plans to keep the stream pristine by any means. So they dump these fireworks to completely soak them in water that were overloaded. They would not be accepted in the safety standards of the day, so they had to be destroyed. That was the easiest way to destroy them, into the water. Well, that felt like a terrible waste to people that were interested in fireworks. We had in the system where they could stretch across this Wharton Brook just about 200 or 300 yards from the factory, and right up next to South Elm Street, we could stretch across this brook, turkey fence. Turkey fence has about a 1-inch, 3/4-inch mesh there on it, and all the way across the fence. But a lot of the fireworks we found didn't all stop in that fence. Some of them meshed on through and on down below, you know, so we were losing part of the process of the saving. So we got burlap sacks, which were porous in those days. A real network of pores, and you stretch that across the turkey fence, and boy, it slowed the stream up a little bit, especially when they got a good dump truck load of stuff that hit it. And the reason we found all this about was a neighbor, a friend that was in this, that was down the street, good quarter, half mile from where we were, was Edgar Gardner. And he was a inveterate experimenter, too, of that day. And he said we could stop those fireworks, and he'd know when they were dumping, so we could have a handy crew, immediate access for salvage purposes. Well, he called the minute he said they're dumping tonight. So we got our bicycles, scream on down the street half a mile to where back as this fireworks bridge was dumping, and the dumping was over. We had a little point around a curve where our net was stretched and nobody could see it, and we, in the night, with our rudimentary rakes and dish pans, we would salvage all the stuff off the net there. And these said it would be fancy salutes, all beautifully colored, but all beginning to soak and withered, and you bring them all onto this muddy bank up there, and we stretch them all out on newspapers and whatnot as best we could. And then we would open these rolls of cardboard that roll just like the end of a cardboard roll in a toilet tissue thing, just unroll everything. And there in the middle was a good 3/8 inch thick or more, or less, depending upon the size of the 2-inch, 3-inch, 6-inch, whatever salute, was a big string of silver gray, light colored explosive. And this was flash powder made in the days to keep firecrackers bright when they went off. And also to help the burning rates, they had 4FG black powder mixed with aluminum salt, aluminum flakes, fine flash flakes, and some magnesium thrown in too, made phenomenal bright lights on top of the standard 4F black powder. But it was a fine black powder that was mixed with this stuff. But it came out a silvery gray. We take all that out, spread it all out, and bring it in little piles. The only place we could store them was mayonnaise jars, the big ones. Anyway, some people, I thought they were a quart on the mountain. If that was big enough for us to handle, we'd fill up our quart jars as fast as we could and then take them off and get out under the cover of darkness so nobody would surprise us in our enterprise. We get home, we get that stuff. Now that stuff was mighty good stuff that we knew was no good soaking wet. Now, there's no way you can salvage them without a dehydration process, which is not too fast, but just efficient. Now, on the windowsill, you can't do it because you spread it out in any kind of container, and it's suspect from the adults in the place. So we said, oh, dear. Well, you can't take it out and put it over an electric hot plate. That's really dangerous. You can't do that. And so you have to think of a better way. I took our mother's cookie tin, which at nighttime, not being used, we could spread it all through. It had a lip about a half inch all the way around. Oh, it's 18 to 20 inches by about another 14 inch wide. And it spread it all out even there, a quarter inch thick all the way across the top of that. And then we take it downstairs at night after the folks had all gone to bed in our slipper feet, and we place it on a couple of bricks on top of the coal-fired furnace that my father worked on to get to burn pea coal with a special rheostat to run off an old Hoover vacuum cleaner. It was a rheostat in series bulbs with 20, 30, 60, 8 watt bulbs that you could turn, and depending on the RPM, you wanted to keep the coals just right for night. My father would set it off for the night, go up to bed, and we would run down with our process and put it on top of this furnace to dry, slow and even, all night. And of course, we had to be up before our father was up, because we had to get down and remove this item from the top of the furnace. But this is the house, 1780. Post and beam built 3 centuries ago. And baby, that was born really, really dry wood. It'd never been anything better, tinderbox, than that. And we had to be mighty careful in our processing. And to bring that up, and then finally have storage systems of dried powder. Now, this was phenomenal. This powder we found in the handmade ceremonial cannons that Dana fabricated. We had to use the original plumbing system that we had with black iron pipe. Now, a 1-inch black iron pipe with about 2 inches of that stuff in the bottom with a wad on top, and first just wad with no projectiles at all, and the fuse touched off was one crescendo of flash. And we look up and smoke cleared, and we went up to the test device and look inside, and there was what was left. The garage shook a pretty bad beating on it, but there was a pipe that looked like a banana being split. The back end had disappeared. It was all opened up, spread even, big balloon there, jagged edges. Oh boy, well that was no good. We couldn't use it because it had too fast a burning rate, which meant we had to modify the burning rates of this detonations of this type of powder. So we had to mix it with our old formula. And that took a little more experimenting, but it turned out to be about half and half of our own formula with the new formula. We could still get it in the gun barrel and get it to go correctly without destroying this homemade gun barrel. But there was really no real scientific quality control, so you once in a while you had a slip up. But meanwhile, every time we test these off, the 2-foot fuses, they wouldn't dare get down to a foot because we were safe enough to get far enough away behind a tree when we test them off. This was in the backyard in Wallingford, Connecticut. And we went down behind the playhouse, which is an old chicken house, converted to make it into a sheriff's office. And that was a great place, and it was a safety zone. We'd get behind that, and everything was all set. Everything was going, and we'd have some phenomenal big ones that went off pretty bad. And then a couple more we saw were bad. And my father came down one day and saw him in the woodshed, somehow, getting kindling. And he said, "My God, fellas, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, we're trying to get our old cannons to work with our old homemade black iron." He says, "My fellas," he said, "don't you realize you can't use this black iron? You've got to use seamless brass tubing." Oh, thanks for the tip. Yeah, now that wasn't He wasn't a killjoy by any means, but he was practical. He had 1,000 things to do. Had his own work after work, plus the work after night, overtime and stuff. Oh, they were doing all kinds of things going on down at the factory. They had to start making stuff for overseas, lend-lease. It was awful. Europe was in flames by this time. And, well, we ended up getting brass tubing. I remember going in there to buy the tubing from Daily Plumber. And he says, geez, your dad must be doing an awful lot of plumbing down there. And we say, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And we take away our links, especially threaded on one end, only a foot and a half long. They were very specialized. Didn't need the other end threaded. He says, really? Well, what a fitting you got on that. And just one end. That's all we wanted. And he says, okay. And look, okay. We got home with those, and that worked. They were much better, more efficient, everything. Now, they made a bigger crack and a noise. And one time, with an awful big, we knew that we were going to bad reaction in the village when you see all the smoke come out from the back of the building after you touch one off. And we'd all be on our bicycles, and suddenly we'd jump and disappear in a fan fashion. Never all together in a clump, but just disappear different parts of the country. And then sort of come back a half hour later to see if things would calm down. Everything was going good until one day coming back in, here was George Enema waiting in the yard. And he says, you know, fellas, he says, I know you're fooling around here with Buff. He said, but don't do it anymore. He said, every one of my raised Buff Potion Prime Fair Show Bantams, chickens, right there in Wallingford. No zoning in those days. And he said, they're refusing to lay and it's giving us a hard time with them. So take your stuff elsewhere to try it out. Oh, okay. Well, that was fair enough, almost. We had to wait until weekend when we went to Goshen, Massachusetts. Old farm. Grandfather's. 40 acres on the lakes, up in the hills, remote. Place to test all kinds of stuff. Well, that's good. We got off the races to taste the days off that we could get to go up there in the 1930 Auburn, I remember, my father's, and we got up to Route 5, no more 5 and 10 all the way, and every stoplight had to stop and wait for it to go. Oh boy, if we had our rabbits and our chickens and our white rats and all everything else, and my brother blew the bugle inside there at every stoplight, and that stopped everybody looking at it. Out to the left, like a bunch of Okies moving to California after being dusted out. Looked no different, but here it was, New England, with all this crew latched up and running boards to luggage racks off the back, and a jam full of people and animals. Well, anyway, we get up there with our stuff, and we had a place to try it out. Boy, we had a place to try it out. We got right down there to the lake shore as fast as we could with these, and we had a mold. Now, we had to make a mold because it was too hard to find projectiles that would be ballistically stable over any kind of range. So you had to manufacture something which is the heaviest economically available metal of the day for projectiles, which was lead. Now, lead came in many forms, but it also came in a tin combination form. They used to make tinfoil balls or buy anything. The confectionery stores were wrapped in tinfoil. The tinfoil you'd keep and you roll it into stuff as big as softballs sometimes. And that stuff was beautifully soluble at low temperatures. It liquefied. With our mother's older soup ladles that had been semi-cast off because of burned handles, we could use those to melt over the gas range in the kitchen. When it was shopping time for the adults and we were home, we could do that. And cast our own projectiles in a mold made from, first of all, the marble that was the right size for the barrel under testing at that time. And you used a shoe polish, empty, top and bottom. And in that tin, plaster of Paris, put in there, fresh, with the water all mixed. And then you'd press with a wax pair or ring between the two, you'd press in the marble with a nail spike that would be just above the diameter you want to reach up to the edge of the can, which is a groove cut in there, so you could hold an opening with a nail and a marble, wax pair, just press the whole thing together, let it harden overnight, pull it apart, toss the wrap, the nail and the marble out, paper out, and you've got a mold. You pour into that after using a vise, put it in a vise gently, the felt, old felt hat with the jaws, and just put it together slowly, and you pour into this the mold, place the manufacture the bowls of the diameter that your dummy worked out as. Well, then we had a mold, and man, we could make our own from that moment on. Well, it was a little tedious, but we did it. And nobody got burned. We were very careful. Didn't get the splashes, we didn't have any much safety gear at the moment, but we didn't get any, everything was dehydrated. It didn't fool around with any water. Okay, we had those up there, Goshen, to test out, put them in that barrel, rammed home the good stuff, powder, plus the rods, and put the projectiles in, and we had a lake. It was approximately a half a mile, well, a third of a mile across and a mile long. Well, by God, we could use a long, long range chesting, and we could. And you... Our range was by testing across the lake with the L hinge, and you could see the effectiveness of the distance. You could hear the bullets as they stop the water and then skip, and then watch the little guys as they skip up all the way into the trees and rattle up the way through the DAR forest. What do you know? This was phenomenal. We had range now. Meanwhile, we couldn't own guns, you know. It had to be all done without a federal firearms license system at all. Anyway, we had the target of the boat made of a 2x10 pointed end, and then we put a little cabin on the top of, and then the cabin had a little mesh screen of fly screen, a little framework that held it up there, and inside the fly screen little cabin there, we had 360 degree observation all around that captain did. And that ship, we put a little live trapped field mouse. We put him into the little cabin and let him be our test device. Put a quad flag on it, little penny flag just used in the parades for kids, and pushed it way out. Battled ashore with the canoe, lined up the gun crew, and by the numbers, we loaded and fired. And it was, oh geez, you could see it at 3 feet high, and then you see it at 6'2" low, and then 2 foot low. Hey, we're getting closer, and then just a little bit further. And meanwhile, the slight breeze from the west is moving it farther and farther out. So we had to keep hurrying up to getting another reload and fire. Bingo. And then finally, after a series of loads and fires, there was one splinter, and my God, we could see pieces of kindling in the air, and there was no more stability of the craft that was launched. Stop. Well, that meant the unit no longer had a viable captain, and I remember saying, oh, gee, well, that's all over. But then I remember seeing my brother and my cousin, we were all, you know, 12, 10, 8 years of age, in that order, myself, my brother, and my cousin. And we could see a little V coming toward shore, an absolute straight line. It looked like a little tiny shark was coming with some sort of a scimitar that was cutting the water, making a V. We couldn't see it any closer and closer and closer. God, it kept coming closer and closer. It was a tiny head of a mouse that was swimming for shore. And boy, he had one thing in mind, that was dry land. So he was making it, no circles or circuitous routes. So that guy went straight as a die all the way for the shore. And he made it. So that was a really revealing episode. But we had to quit the whole thing in the lake after an individual came over to this place. and he's an owner of a camp on the southeast shore of the lake. We were on the northwest, and we were using the northeast shore for our test. There was nobody around in those areas, but down below, he said, "Did you know that those bullets that you're firing from that gun," ooh, we said the word like it was terrible, "was are entering the woods?" So we were told that whatever you do, you don't do that anymore by all other adults in the vicinity. So that stopped all our long-range study up to then. But anyway, we had to learn. This is our way of learning, and I'm so grateful that we did have our own indoctrination with guns before we could even own them. So this was great. My father didn't seem to worry too much about it until later on when I got my first 22 rifle. But we won't talk about that. That's another story. Bye now. Wayne, a few things I forgot. Got to explain a few things I forgot. Just before I entered the stage when I was finally allowed to have a 22 rifle with my father's permission, he was conscious enough of the dangers of using a muzzle-loading device of any kind that didn't have wall thickness for safety. And he drilled a 1.5-inch diameter pipe, a solid 1020 steel bar with a 1/2-inch diameter hole, a good foot long, inside with a touch hole for a fuse and powder, but he had a 1/2-inch wall thickness all the way around for the device, and that was the barrel from then on that could be used. And also at that time, Ed Till got a whole bunch of antique gun stuff that his uncle had left him. And he was another 12-year-old, and it was stuff that they didn't think we'd ever use. It was all muzzle-loader stuff. But in there was about a 1/2-inch diameter round ball mold. Boy, did we go to town with that. That helped out our loading facility faster, and we were able to make a safer unit. And everything went much better for it, but we had to be very careful with any long-range stuff. It was just enough for the accuracy at given ranges so we could stop him in our own wood pile. But at least he made the... just a little while ago, I remember seeing the what was left of that original safety device my father had made for us. But all before we could have a gun of any kind. So that was pretty good. Well, I'll sign off now. Bye now.